Our speaker is Kathy A. from Redding, California. He first came around the NA program in 1958. In 1962, he came back to this day, and he'd like to tell you his story. Thank you.
My name is Kathy, and I'm a recovering drug addict. And I'm nervous. I think Cookie described exactly how I feel. And I too was so nervous I couldn't even make my dinner. And I even had to get up and go pee. But I want you to know that I consider this a privilege and an honor to have been asked to come and share with you my experience and my strength and my hope. And I'm here because I need that from you people. Your experience, your strength, and your hope. Because as far as I'm concerned, this is what the Fellowship of Narcotics is all about. No more and no less. And several weeks ago, a friend of mine, Gene from Ashland, Oregon, was coming up from Los Angeles. That he had just come back from the conference in Houston, Texas, and he stopped by on his way home, and we had a good visit, and he told me about the convention, and I was so happy, and I was kind of disappointed because I had planned to make that conference in Houston, Texas, but things came up, and it was just impossible for me to go. And that's when he told me that he had met some real, real beautiful people from here from Oregon. And that he said, you might be getting a call from a guy named Logan, and he probably will be asking you to be the speaker at their convention in Oregon. And I got kind of nervous, and in a way I was hoping that he wouldn't call. Because I'm not a speaker. And I get very nervous. But anyway, I didn't say nothing to anybody. And sure enough, a couple of days later, I got a call from Logan, and he asked me if I would speak. And I've never refused to do anything for the program. That's my program. It's given so much to me, I can't say no. And I told him I would accept on the condition that if something came up and I just really couldn't make it, that I would call up with plenty of time that he can get somebody else. And then I started to look for some excuses, not that and things just worked out. I talked it over with my wife, and I told her, you know what, it's so hard now. It's getting harder and harder for me to talk, to give a pitch, because some of the main points of my talk is I talk about a very terrible tragedy that happened in my life. And it's hard for me to talk about it. And she said, well, you know, you do what you have to do. And then I said, you know, I feel bad because I don't want to give the impression that I'm up here sniveling, because I'm not. You know? And I remember the last time I spoke, you know, I cried and a lot of people cried and it's real hard. But she said, look, that's your story. You know, that's what you have to share. And she said, you know, where better can you share it but with a bunch of people who are your brothers and sisters, and they really know where you're coming from. And he says, you gotta go. So I'm here. And I'm getting way ahead of myself, and so I'm gonna start in the beginning. And as far as I'm concerned, my beginning is when I came to this thing. You know, as far as the past, I don't want to really get into that. You know, I did a lot of things, and I tried a lot of dope, and And I ended up in a lot of places where they send drug addicts, and I ran crazy for almost 20 years. I will say, I was a young kid, and I got busted for my first possession in 1948. I was just a youngster. And I did time. I did 13 months in a reform school in Northern California, and I got out of there, and I was out 3 days, and I went back, another position. And then for the next 20 years, I was in and out of institutions all over the United States. I was never, the longest I ever stayed on the street was 19 months. And I came to this program, and like I said, like Nancy said, in 1958, I had just been released from a hospital in Los Angeles. It was a psychiatric unit, and I had been there to sick. I was awfully sick. I had a pretty bad run, and I was using methadone at the time. And I had a doctor in Brentwood where I was living, and I was pretty heavy. And at that time, they didn't know too much about methadone at that time. They didn't know that the way you withdraw people from methadone is just to cut them down little by little. I went into the hospital and they cut me cold turkey, and they gave me something for the pain, they gave me something for the nausea, and they gave me something for, the diarrhea and the vomiting and all this, and I almost died. I went into convulsions for about 3 or 4 days. And I was in the hospital for 14 days. And it was then that I met a guy. And I remember when I had gotten over the critical part, I was beginning to mellow off, and this guy walked in, and he had on a blue suit and a white shirt and a real nice wine tie, and he had a funny little walk, and he walked in, and he says, "I'm looking for, Joe Blow, because I was there and on an alias." And I said, and I looked at him, I said, "Oh my God, he's a federal agent." And they're going to bust me. They know I'm running, and he said, "My name is Scott, and I'm from Narcotics Anonymous. Have you ever heard of Narcotics Anonymous?" And I said, "Yeah, I had heard about it, and I had heard about AA, but I never experienced any meetings, I never knew anybody that was involved." And for the next week, he would come every night to visit me. And he was a guy that cared with me and told me about this program. And they were going to send me to a state hospital, and I was scared to death because eventually they'd find out that I was a parolee at large, and I go back to the federal joint. And he told me that if I wanted to go out and go to some meetings, he would arrange it. And I said, fine. And that's when I made my first meeting after I was released from the hospital. I wasn't clean. I was still awfully sick. I was still on medication. And I went to my first meeting in Studio City. And at that time, there was only one meeting a week in California. In fact, there was only one meeting a week in the world. And I still remember the guys that were there. It was a guy named Sky, a guy named Grant Withers, a guy named Jimmy Cannon, his brother Gary Cannon, and my which later became my sponsor, Scott. And I went to quite a few meetings, and I met some beautiful people, and I was introduced to the program. Like I said, I never got clean, and I was staying with Scott in Studio City, and I left because I started using again. And I ran crazy for a little longer, and then I did something that I had never done before in my life. It seemed like I had gotten to the end of the line. And I went and I gave myself up. I had never done that. I had never put the finger on myself. And I went and I walked into the federal building. I want to see an RPO, and I said, you know what? I can't stop. I want to stop, but I can't do it. They put me in the county jail, and a couple of weeks later, they sent me back to Texas. I had been there before. It was a hospital in Fort Worth, Texas. I spent 2 years in the hospital, and I was introduced to psychiatric treatment, and I had gone through hypnosis, and I had individual therapy and group therapy, and I wasn't able to stay clean. And I went back, and I went through a real, real bad depression. I went to what they call orientation unit, and after I left the orientation unit, I went into the general population, and I didn't want to stay there. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't. There wasn't any answers there for me, and I refused to go into the population. I refused to be assigned to a job. I refused to cooperate with anybody. And they put me in what they call the Burford unit. It's a lockup, and they put me in the cell. And I stayed there for 2 months. And finally, when they realized that there wasn't anything they could do, they decided to kick me out. And I remember the doctor, he came down to see me, Dr. Davis, came down and said, you know, Manuel, he said, your problem is that basically, you are so immature that you can't handle life off there. And there's nothing we can do to help you. And at this point, there's nothing we can do. You're a hopeless, sick drug addict. And you're gonna die. And he says, the only way that you'll get out of this is there's gonna have to be a drastic change in your whole personality, in your whole being. Like you said, at this point, I don't think that's impossible. I mean, I don't think that's possible. You're a very sick man. And at this point, we find that you're a detriment to the institution, and we're going to have you transferred out. So I was transferred to the Dallas County Jail, and several weeks later, a federal team came by, and I was on my way to Leavenworth, Kansas, finish up my sentence. When I got to Leavenworth, I was there several months, and I wrote a letter to the Attorney General in Washington. At that time, it was a guy named Bennett. And I requested that they send me to California. There was an institution in Seminole Island, California, and I wanted to be close to home. I said, you know, when I get short and I get ready to be released, I'll have a better opportunity to get in touch with somebody and maybe get a job and find a place to live. And he granted my transfer. And I came to California. And when I was in the institution, I used to work as a dental technician. And one night, I had about 7 months to do. One night they came and they woke me up about 4 o'clock in the morning and said, roll them up. And I said, well, where in the hell am I going? I said, just roll them up. Get all your gear, put it in a pillowcase, and just go. And they took me down, and they started checking me out. I found out they were transferring me to a place in Stanford, Arizona, prison center. They needed a dental technician there, and they just shanghaied me and sent me there. And when I got there, they had a real nice group that used to come in from town. I used to take guys to town once in a while for AA meetings. And I became pretty active in AA. And after I was there, I was released from there. I came and I came to the program, came back to NA. All during the time I was there, I had remembered and I had seen something that I couldn't deny. I had actually met some drug addicts that were clean. I had seen them, I had talked to them, I had been to their home, I had seen the way they lived, and they were clean. I couldn't deny that. And deep down inside, I thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice if that could happen to me? And I used to think, gee, wouldn't it be nice to someday get rid of this yen? But I used to say, gee, but if I get rid of it, it would be like to be normal. And I'm not normal. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I really didn't. But I knew that there was something drastically wrong. I didn't live like other people. And when I came back to the program, there's a guy who is here tonight. And one day he was talking about how he felt, and he described how I felt much better than I could have ever put it. And it's Rick Madeline. He said one night in a meeting, he said, you know, before coming to this program, I had this feeling inside that I grew up with this feeling that for some reason or other, I felt like I wasn't going to make it in this world. And that's how I felt. I said, gee, that's how I feel. I always felt that way. That for some reason or other, and I couldn't understand why, I wasn't going to make it in this world. I became kind of active in NAA, and I started going to meetings. And I didn't do too much institution work or any cooperative work. I went to meetings, and I didn't take things. I stayed clean for 6 months, the first time in my life since I had started using drugs, that I was able to take clean 6 months. And I went to a party one time, and it was my kid brother, and he was having a party, and he was drinking, and I said no, and he offered me some more, and later on I said no, and finally I told myself, well, I'm going to have just one beer. Just one beer. Maybe two, but that's it. You know? And the next thing I remember, I was drunk, just on beer, for 4 days. Yeah. On the fifth day, I took a day trip. And I was off running again. And in December the 6th of 1962, at 7 o'clock in the morning, I took my last trip, and I went to Finland. I stayed there, and I was released. Well, I split. I split from Synanon on Christmas Day. And that is the most significant day of my life. Something happened that day that I said, you know, I'm going to make it. I'm going to do whatever I have to do. I know it isn't going to be easy, but I'm going to do whatever I have to do, and I'm going to get back to this program. What happened was that I left Synanon, and I walked down Olympic Boulevard in Santa Monica, and there was a kid selling papers, and the clothes I had on was all I had. I was bald-headed, and I didn't have any money, and there was a kid selling papers, and they told me he would loan me a dime. I was going to make a collect call to Los Angeles, and I gave him his dime back. And he said, sure. And I called my mother's house. Now, I hadn't called my mother's house in a long, long time. My family didn't want nothing to do with me. And I called Mama's house because I knew that on Christmas Day, everybody went to Mama's house. I got a large family. I have 8 sisters and I have 6 brothers. And when they all get together with all their kids, Mama's house is a fun house, you know. And they had menudo and tamales, and you know, and it was just beautiful there on Christmas when I was a kid. And I called Mama's house, and my brother-in-law, Artie, got the phone. And I said, Artie, I'm in Santa Monica, and I'm stranded. I just left Synanon, and I don't have any money. Is my brother there, or my dad, or you? You know, could you come and pick me up? And he had a few drinks, and he just, you know what, Pippi, I'm going to tell you something that the whole family has been wanting to tell you for a long time, but they just haven't had the balls to tell you. I said, what's happening, Marty? I said, you know, you've been a pain in the ass of this family for 20 years now. He said, you made your mother sick, you made your father sick, you made your sister sick, you lied to us, you robbed us. He said, man, do us a favor and don't come here. And I sat there, you know. And I thought to myself, I said, you know what? The man is right. So I stood in the corner and I didn't know where I was going to go. And I started hitchhiking and a guy came by in a little Volkswagen and gave me a ride. I guess he thought far from then being a dollar. And I made it all the way hitchhiking to Los Angeles, and I was standing in the corner of, I think it's 8 Springs, where Spring Street and Main meet in L.A. I was standing in the corner wondering, where in the hell am I going to go? I can't go to East L.A., because if I go there, I know I'll lose. I can't go to Mama's house. And along comes an old partner of mine that I hadn't seen in a long time, and he was looking good. And I remember when, you know, I used to give him a lot of dope at one time. And he saw me, and I was looking pretty bad, and he said, "Steffi, there's not much I can do, but just send out." I said, "Well, at least I'm not going to be in the street tonight. I have enough to get a room." And I said, "But, you know, where in the heck am I going to go?" And I thought, well, the first bus that comes by, wherever that bus is going, that's where I'm going to go. And the first bus that came by said Glendale. And that's where I went. And the funny thing, you know, I got off of the bus in Glendale on Broadway Street, and just a half a block down was the Alano Club. And the AA Alano Club, and that's where I spent my Christmas. I had coffee and donuts and a lot of good conversations and a lot of good friendships. I got a room that night, and the next day, you know, I thought about what had happened the day before, with Art and my family, and I said, you know, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. The truth is here. The truth is here. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to see Scott again, and I'm going to go back, and I'm going to see these people, and I want them to show me how to do it. And I knew that, you know, I told myself, you know, I know there's a God. And I know that if I do the right thing, only good will come to me. If I do the right thing. Because I had read it somewhere, or I had heard it somewhere, not, I don't know where, but I had read or heard something like, if you do what is right, you know, with all the honesty that you can have in your heart, God will help you. He's obligated to help you. But if you don't do what's right, He's not obligated to do anything. And I said, I would try. I got up out of that room, and I started walking down the residential district, and I started knocking on doors. The lady, I'll cut you down for $1. I'll send them hedges for $1.50. And I wanted to work. And I remember about the third house I stopped. This lady told me she had a lot of cracks in the back. She wanted me to clean up and cut the lawn and trim the hedges. And I started working, and about 20 minutes later, she told me, "Why don't you come on in the back?" And I went in the back, and she had a real nice patio out there, and she had some wrought iron furniture with glass on top, and she had made me breakfast. And I still remember she had some orange marmalade. Still remember. I sat there and I ate my breakfast, and I got up and I cleaned that face like it had never been cleaned. And I've been working ever since. I'm not a meat anymore. You know, I used to consider myself, I was a hustler and a fast talker and all that, you know. But in reality, I was a leech. I leaked off of my family, I leaked off of my friends, and the people I couldn't leak off of, I stole from. And I leaked off of young women on welfare, or old women on welfare. And today I'm not a leech. I've learned how to carry my own weight. And I became active on the program. And that's when I started to meet people like Bob Barrett, like the Magdaleno boys. And they became my family, like Dean Hayes and other people. A lot of us, and they became my family, like Dean Hayes and other people. A lot of other people that really helped me, were very instrumental in my growing up. And things began to happen. You know, I started to work on a little job. One of my first jobs I had was washing dishes, and then I had another steady job doing landscaping work, and things got better, and pretty soon I got a job in a factory. And then later on, I got another good job. And I went to work in this place where they used to make tile. And during this time, I had run across and I met this young lady in AA who had much more sobriety than I had. And we started, we lived together for a long time. And she helped me, and I helped her. We kept each other company, and we loved each other. And whenever she needed some help, I was there. And when I needed some help, she was there. And later on, we decided we were going to get married, and we did. And like I said, things really started to happen. A year after I was sober, my first son was born. And man, I was so happy. I never thought anything like this would happen. I never could really picture myself, bouncing a little baby on my knee. I couldn't see it. Maybe it was that deep inside I thought that I was going to die young. I never could picture myself as an old man, retired, with grandchildren. I couldn't see it. And here it was beginning to happen. My first son was born a year after I was pregnant, on the same month. He was born on December the 2nd. My birthday was on December the 6th. And his initials is AA. And from then, a lot of good things began to happen. I went to work for a company one time, a roofing company, and I went to work as a laborer. I was making $1.50 an hour, but there was a lot of opportunity there. There was an opportunity for me to learn, to join the union, to make good money, and I went there and I worked hard. And a year later, I was the owner of that company. I was not only the owner, but I was the president of a small little corporation. And man, I felt like $1 million. I used to run around all over Los Angeles and the counties around there, doing a lot of work, 12-step work. I was very, very involved. In fact, I bought a brand new Volkswagen one time, and it was just it was a year when these Volkswagens came out with this automatic transmission. And about a brand new one, just right out of the showcase. And in 3 months, I put over 50,000 miles on this thing. And within 5 months, I had to put another motor. I was really active, man. One night I'd be at CIW, another night I'd be at Pino, and another night I'd be in Tehachapi. I was running like I had been running before, but in a different way. And this is the kind of a hype I was. I was running all the time. If I stopped to get a hot dog at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was slowing down. And I kept running, but in a positive way. I was working steady, and things were going good, and I bought a beautiful little home in Eagle Rock where I had my business, and things were just beautiful. And several years later, my second son was born. He was born on Labor Day. And this little guy had a lot of problems. He was born immature, and he was real small. He only weighed 3 pounds. Little tiny baby. And he was in an incubator for a long time. And the first year, it was just touch and go. Respiratory problems. And he had pneumonia quite a bit, and he had a collapsed lung, and there for a year, he really had to take care of this little thing. And it was during that time that I began to notice that my older boy was having trouble walking. He was beginning to trip. And he had very unusual legs. He had very muscular legs. He didn't like the little weightlifter. They were muscles. Not just little baby fat, muscular legs. And even people, He put on his little prancing and swimming trunks and he walked on the street and people were seeing him pissing him off. But he had muscles up here in his calves and the bottom of his calves and up here. And he looked like a little weightlifter, cute little guy. And we were beginning to see he was having trouble. He was beginning to trip. And then he couldn't run too good. So we took the boys down to the clinic and we had them examined by the doctor. And he said, look, why don't you let the boys stay here overnight? We want to give them an intensive examination. And that night they called us up and said, would you please come down to the hospital? We'd like you to sign some releases. We want to give your boy a biopsy in his leg. We want to find out what his problems are. So we went down to the hospital and we signed a release and they gave him a little biopsy. They put into his muscle and they took a little piece of the muscle out and put him back. And they ran all these through tests. And a couple of days later we went back to the doctor and he told us that my two boys had muscular dystrophy. And I didn't know what the hell that was. I had heard muscular dystrophy, I'd heard about it before, you know. So I thought, well, what the heck, you know, we'll take him to the clinic and they'll give him medicine and they'll get well. And so my wife said, well, I'm going to write to the Muscular Dystrophy Association in New York and get all the information we can so we can help the boys. So she wrote to the Muscular Dystrophy Foundation in New York, and a couple of weeks later, I came home from work, and she was in the house, and she was crying. I said, well, what's the matter? She said, read that. I sat down, I began to read it, and my boys have a terminal thing. Prognosis is negative. It's one of the number one killers of children. My world came to an end. You got to excuse me when I get... It's very hard for me to talk about it. My world came to an end. They have Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And very lucky if they live to be 17 years old. And the next day, I didn't go to work. I didn't open up the shop. I called up the guy. I said, there's no work today. Take a day off. Jumped in the car, and I drove around, and I went to my mama's house. And I poured my heart out to her. And then for a long time there was no laughing. I wasn't interested in anything. I didn't watch TV. I didn't give a damn about the business. And things started getting worse. And then I began to get very angry. I remember one day I was sitting down and I said, oh God, you three. And I cussed him out. I said, man, haven't I suffered enough? Why do you have to do this to us? And it sort of seems like, you know, when you're so angry, you take it out on the closest ones. And it was very impossible to be alone. And I took it out on family. Things got worse, and my wife and I, we grew apart. We didn't sleep together no more. We didn't kiss no more. We didn't hug each other no more. And I began to feel sorry for myself. And I sold the business. The hell with it. By this time, I had gotten in debt. I wasn't doing any more work. And he said, gee, what are we going to do with all these bills, man? We're $80,000 in the hole. I said, awesome. They can't get no blood out of a turnip. And then we began to argue, and we began to fight. And one day, man, we got in a real bad thing, and before I knew what the hell happened, man, I punched her out. I blackened her eye, broke her glasses, I cut her eye. I said, Jesus Christ, it was me. And I moved out of the house. And for the next almost 2 years, I buried myself in work. I worked two full-time jobs. I never missed a day. I was never late. I never took a vacation. I just worked. I took care of the family. Took care of my responsibilities. I had to get a lot of things straight now with the Internal Revenue and a lot of other things. So I started paying back my bills. I had to get things. I couldn't leave my family like that. And then I began to get sick. I had so much bitterness and anger inside, and it began to make me sick, physically sick. I began to have headaches and stomach trouble. I went and I went to see a woman that I had worked with. And she was an elderly woman. She was a retired psychologist, and she used to do counseling on the volunteer counseling a couple of times a week. And I went and I told her, "B, I've got to talk. I need some help. I'm going crazy." And this woman really helped me. I was able to go back home and try to start to be nice to my family. I was able to get back, and we were able to talk things out, my wife and I, and we became real good friends once again. I didn't live there no more, you know. But I used to go over and make sure that they had the things they needed. And she was going through a hell of a thing. Because she was home and she had to face all this. She began to have a lot of troubles with the school. They didn't want my boy in school. They were afraid that he was going to get hurt and they would be liable. And they said, "Look, why don't you keep him home for a while until we find out what we're going to do, and then we'll decide. You know, we'll get together and we'll talk." And they sent him home, and he didn't go to school for 3 months. And the bad thing about it is that I had bought a beautiful little home in Eagle Rock. It was right across the street from the school. And they didn't want him in the school. Finally, we got together with him, and we forced their hand. "What are you going to do?" So they decided that they wanted my boy to go every day and stand in front of his school where all his little friends were and get on a bus and ship him to East LA to school for the cripple. That's it. Later, so I'll put him in a Montessori school, or I'll put him in a special school. But I'm not going to do that to him. Because he doesn't see himself as a handicapped kid. He doesn't see himself. Little guy's he's an inspiration to me. He sees himself as normal. He sees himself as beautiful. And he sees himself as temporarily out of commission, but he's coming back. Fantastic. His outlook is emotionally, that little guy is in beautiful shape. And we began to talk, and I used to go home because I wanted to try to help the wife and find out what the hell we're going to do. And finally I said, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? He says, "I want to leave Los Angeles." I went to work the next day, and I told my boss, "I'm going to take a week off. I have some real serious problems at home, and I want to take care of them. I'm taking a week off." He says, "Go ahead." Went to my other job, and I told my boss the same thing. He says, "Go ahead." I came home, and I said, "Honey, tomorrow morning, I want you to get up early and get the kids ready. Pack a big lunch. I'm going to come and I'm going to help you get a mattress, and we're going to throw it in the back of the station wagon, and we're going up north." She said, "Well, where are we going?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "We're going up north. We're going to find a place where the air is clean. We're going to find a place where they'll accept my boys in public school. We're going to find a place where we're going to make a whole new life for ourselves. I want to come home." This boy, she said. So we got in the car the next day, and we started driving, and we passed through Fresno, Stockton. She said, "Gee, how far are we going?" I said, "There's a place up north called Redding. I know some people who live there, and they say it's beautiful there. There's beautiful lakes, and there's streams, and there's country, there's farms, and there's cows and there's chickens. Just go check it out. And we drove into Redding about 11 o'clock, a couple of days before Thanksgiving. And that day it had been raining all day. And when we drove in, it was partly cloudy, it was beginning to clear up, everything was wet, and you could smell the ground, you know. And man, it looked beautiful. The visibility was choromiles of miles away, you know. There's hundreds of miles that you could see. Clear, clear, and Jesus Christ, that air was so clean. And we got a motel that night, and the next day, I said, you know what, how do you like it? He said, well, just go look around. And we went and we went down to the lake, to Lake Shasta. We drove out to Whiskeytown Lake. I said, you know what, there's two or three more lakes about 40 miles away. They call them Trinity Lakes. And we saw the rivers and the streams, and we went down to a little place called French Gulch. French Gulch looks like a little place where Huckleberry Finn lives. The only difference is the street is paved. But if the street was dirt, you'd think you were in the little town where Huckleberry Finn lives. And at the end of the little town, they have a little park, and there's a stream that runs through called Pearl Creek. And the kids go swimming there, and they go fishing there, and they pan for gold there. There's a lot of gold up in that country. And it's just a beautiful place. And she said, let's move the vase. And we had gone real early in the morning, right after breakfast. And that night I had gotten a paper, and there were several places that were for rent. So the next day we went out and we checked a couple of places out, and we found a place. It was about a block away from the Sacramento River. It was on low ground. It was on South Redding. There was farms around there, and she liked it. She liked the little house. I put 3 months rent down. I turned on the utilities. That same day, I called up and I said, I'm going to be leaving back to L.A. I thought I'd have it done as soon as I can. And they sent somebody right over. They put on the lights and the gas, and we looked it over, and it was a beautiful three-bedroom house. And I locked it up. And by 12:30 that day, we were on our way back to L.A. to pack. And we came back to L.A. 3 weeks later, and moved her to Redding. And I moved her over on a weekend. That Monday, I opened up a bank account and put some money in the bank for her. And I had to go back to L.A., take her some business. I had to resign from my job. And she said, what are you going to do when you get here? I said, I'll make it. Don't worry, I'll make it. And that's something that I have to thank this program for. You know, the courage to do things like that. I had gotten and I had developed enough faith in God that He would provide for me and my family. And 3 months later, I moved with them. I went back to L.A. and I had some property there. I had to rent out the houses and get somebody to take care of them. And I had to resign from my job. And I had to take care of a lot of business. And like I said, in 3 months, I moved to Redding. And we started a whole new life. Everything that has happened to me is a direct result of this program. You know, for many, many years, you know, when I was younger, I used to sit up in the penitentiaries and I used to dream about someday I would leave the institution and I would find a nice woman, I would get married, and I would have some children. And the day would come when I would lose this obsession to use, and I'd have a job, and I'd be clean, and I wouldn't be running anymore. And I used to dream this dream over and over and over again. The next day I'd wake up and there I was in prison. But that was a dream I had for many, many years. A friend of mine came up to visit me one time. The guy that was in the joint with me in Texas a long time ago, 1955. And he said, do you remember we used to talk about that dream? He said, look, man, it's the real man. It's really happening. And I used to dream about, you know, having a woman that would love me and somebody I could love, having some children that love me and that I could love. And my whole thinking began to change. I realized that for a long time I was so angry because things weren't the way I wanted them to be. And I realized that had been my problem all my life. I was never satisfied with what I had. And because I was so unhappy and always wished that things were different, I was rejecting what I had. And I began to just learn from this program to accept exactly what I had. And the way I was really able to do that is my son helped me. He helped me because one day he said, look, this is the card that was dealt to us. Let's play the game the best we can. And this is what I've been trying to do. There's a lot of love in my heart today. I'm closer to my family than I ever thought I would ever be able to be close to people. I love my children like I never thought I had the capability to love. They love me. Fine, he knows that I love him. He knows it. And my boy is 15 years old now. He's in a wheelchair. Our other little boy still walks. He'll be in a wheelchair soon. And my oldest boy still is in public school. He's very active. He has a girlfriend. You know that he goes to dances? He says, you know what? Nobody ever told me that you have to be on your feet to dance. And some of you that were at a convention in Ventura met him. And Lily danced with him. Remember Lily? He was in his wheelchair and he danced with him. He had a ball. He loves this program because he grew up within this program. There are three people that he idolizes in this program. One guy is a baseball, he's a professional baseball player. He plays for Kansas City Royals. He is the shortest Major League Baseball player there is. His name is Fred Paycheck. He's a personal friend of my little boy. Every time Fred Paycheck used to go into to play in Anaheim Stadium, he'd call up Tony and invite him over. And they're real good buddies. And he idolizes him, Fred Paycheck. The other two guys is Hank Magdaleno. He's crazy about him. And the other one is Danny Trejo. He just loves Danny Trejo. Every time I come to a convention or something, he always asks me, did you see Danny? Did you see Hank? I said, yeah. He wanted to come with me, but it's so hard for him. This program has really, really, it saved me. Not only for drug addiction, but it saved me in a lot of things. It's given me the opportunity to learn how to live. For many, many years, I wanted to be involved in living. And today, I'm involved in living. You know, I am not the same person I was when I came. I don't think like him. I don't look like him. I don't live like him. I'm a different person. What has happened to me is the thing that the doctor one day, long time ago in Texas, told me. There has to be a drastic change in your whole everything. And it's happened. It has come to pass. I'm a different person. I'm happy today. I accept what I have. And it's hard for me to talk about it. I get choked up in the whole thing. But you know what? We have a lot of strength in our home. Whatever happens, we can handle it. Because I have people like you. This is my family. Wherever I go, there's always somebody I can call up and talk to and share with them. Because I need your strength and your hope. I need you people. Without you people, I'm nothing. I love every one of you. I've learned that since I've been here. And I've learned how to love myself. I believe with all my heart that I'm a success. I believe that I came into this world to succeed, not to fail. I am here to fulfill myself. I've learned how to be kind to myself. And I've learned how to love myself. For many years, I tried to kill myself. And by love of oneself, I don't mean, you know, going in front of a mirror and saying, I love you, I love you. I don't mean that. I mean that that treasure house within each and every one of us, our self-respect as somebody. I'm no better or no worse than anybody else. I'm me, capable of making mistakes, capable of blunder, but thank God, capable of rising above my mistakes. And I have this program to thank you for that. I have you people who have shown me, who have been with me, who have gained me strength when I needed it, and who are there whenever I need them. I thank you, and my family thanks you, and God bless everyone. Thank you.
Love you, Pat. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah. It's a program full of miracles, you know. After I was around for a while, I began, you know, to get to see the story of the ugly duckling become a beautiful swan, you know, over and over and over, you know. And I don't know where else you can get that at, you know. Shall we stand and close in the usual way with our Father? Oh, I'd like to, you know, before we say the prayer, I'd like to give a hand for all the committee people from Portland. You know, there's quite a few of them. Did a lot of work. I think about the hardest work of us all was Nancy Kellogg. You know, had real hard job. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen. You come back.